is our top stories. An Israeli advocacy group says Tel Aviv has issued tenders for some 2,500 new settler units in the occupied Palestinian territories. Iran blacklists outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump and several of his aides over their role in terrorist acts and violations of human rights. The number of coronavirus deaths in the U.S. exceeds 400,000 as Europe grapples with a surge in fatalities and cases. Those were the top stories. My name is Arash Zahedi. Welcome. This hour's top story, an Israeli advocacy group says Tel Aviv has issued tenders for some 2,500 new settler units on the eve of Joe Biden's swearing in as U.S. president. The Peace Now NGO accused Israel of a mad scramble to promote as much settlement activity as possible until the last minute before the change of administration in Washington. Last Sunday, the regime approved nearly 800 units in the occupied West Bank. An Israeli settlement, all Israeli settlements, mind you, in the occupied Palestinian territories are illegal under international law. But outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's administration declared in 2019 that Washington no longer considered settlements as being in breach of international law. The move came despite the U.N.'s calls for a halt to Israeli settlement activities. Let's give you some reaction to that story. I'm going to bring in Mr. Robert Fantina. He's an author and journalist who joins us via Skype out of Kitchener, Ontario. Sir, it's good to have you with us. Your reaction, please.
Typical of Israel. It disdains international law, doesn't care about it at all. And that contempt for international law was fostered by U.S. President Donald Trump. So in the waning hours of Trump's administration, Netanyahu, who faces re-election in March and has also been indicted for a number of crimes, is trying to shore up his support with the Zionist voting bloc in Israel, which is substantial, and by issuing all these tenders for new illegal settlements. As you pointed out, they are illegal under international law. Trump's declaring of them not illegal is meaningless. Trump is not international law. He was simply the president of the United States. And despite his delusions of grandeur that he ran the world, this was not the case. So Netanyahu and Israel continue to commit war crimes, continue to violate international law, and this is just the latest example of that.
Mr. Fantina, there are a lot of things that Joe Biden's incoming administration has promised to basically take back. I can make mention of the law that prohibited citizens from certain Muslim countries from entering the United States, as well as the Paris Accord. At least there are promises. Would you consider that under President Biden, perhaps some of these policies regarding the settlements, regarding the Israeli policies, will be taken back by the U.S.?
They will be taken back, but only to the degree that they were under previous administrations prior to Donald Trump. They were not strong then. President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, all their predecessors from at least 1967 have condemned settlement activities but done nothing to stop it. And each president could stop it by simply stopping the flow of money that goes from the United States to Israel. But even Biden and Vice President-elect Harris have said that they will not condition aid to Israel on anything Israel does. This, of course, is in violation of U.S. law, which mandates that countries that receive U.S. aid must adhere to certain standards of human rights, which Israel does not. So while we see a rollback from some of Trump's worst policies on Palestine, it would be naive to think that we will see anything extremely positive coming out of a Biden administration.
Thank you very, very much. That's Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Kitchener, Ontario. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you.
Israel has carried out fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip as tensions continue to simmer in the region. Israeli artillery shelled targets in the north and center of the besieged enclave. No casualties have been reported, but material damage has occurred. Israel has confirmed the attacks, claiming they came in response to a rocket launched from northern Gaza on Tuesday evening. Israeli warplanes also launched an attack on southern Gaza on Monday, causing material damage. The surge in attacks comes as Palestinian territories prepare to hold their first parliamentary and presidential votes in 15 years. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has warned of a prompt response to any action against it after being blacklisted by the U.S. The movement said in a statement that it'll take necessary measures to any hostile act outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's administration's designated Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization last week, or terror organization, I should say, only days before President-elect Joe Biden takes over. The move drew international criticism, with the UN and several aid groups warning that the blacklisting risks worsening Yemen's dire humanitarian crisis. In the meantime, Biden's pick for State Secretary Antony Blinken has said the upcoming administration will immediately review the designation to avoid undermining relief efforts. Iran's foreign ministry has released a sanction list of senior U.S. officials involved in terrorist crimes and violation of human rights against the Iranian nation. Topping the list is outgoing President Donald Trump for supporting the assassination of senior nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and ordering the murder of top general Qasem Soleimani. He is also charged with involvement in creating, training, and arming terrorist organizations in West Asia. The statement accuses Trump of committing crimes against humanity by risking the well-being and livelihood of millions of Iranians through illegal and unilateral sanctions. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Acting Pentagon Chief Christopher Miller, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, CIA Director Gina Haspel, Trump's senior advisor Jared Kushner, and his former top aide John Bolton are also on the list. Political commentator David Yagubian says Iran has set the stage to initiate holding U.S. officials accountable for their heinous crimes.
I believe it comes down to fear and vassalage, the fear of much of the international community or many nations regarding American economic power, American military power, the fact that if many of these nations in any way buck American imperial policy, they will find their next election somehow problematic. They will maybe find Takfiri terrorists or other rebels in the woods or in the neighborhoods near their capital. I believe that Iran has pretty much effectively set the stage for justice to ultimately be served. It has set an example for the world once again regarding how to stand up to imperial bullying, how to stand up to illegal and terrorist economic and medical sanctions, how to maintain one's sovereignty and rights under such, let's say, as it's so-called maximum pressure. The United States is not necessarily going to maintain its global imperial power for very long. And so I think it's important that those American political elites who have engaged in such heinous crimes, and as you point out, if they were from another country, they would, of course, be called to the ICC or Interpol would round them up. And so those criminals need to be held accountable for their crimes. And I think American political elites, especially now on the eve of a new Biden administration, need to pay close attention to history and the potential future of accountability for American political elites regarding their ongoing wars, their ongoing occupations, support of covert operators, Takfiri terrorists, etc. This has to stop.
U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's pick for Secretary of State has laid out his Iran policy before a Senate panel as his confirmation process begins.
The President-elect believes that if Iran comes back into compliance, we would too. But we would use that as a platform with our allies and partners who would once again be on the same side with us to seek a longer and stronger agreement. And also, as you and the chairman have rightly pointed out, to capture these other issues, particularly with regard to missiles and Iran's destabilizing activities. That would be the objective. Having said that, I think we're a long way from there.
Antony Blinken noted that the U.S. will make decisions on matters related to Iran in consultations with its allies. In the meantime, Biden's pick to head the Pentagon, General Lloyd Austin, accused Iran of destabilizing West Asia, saying Tehran poses a threat to the American allies and forces stationed there. The anti-Iran remarks were also echoed by Biden's nominee for the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines.
The President-elect has also indicated, and I agree with this, that in doing so, we have to also look at the ballistic missile issues that you've identified, and there are other, obviously, destabilizing activities that Iran engages in.
The comments come as Tehran has repeatedly stressed that it will not accept a conditional U.S. return to the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and reimposed unilateral sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, announced a gradual scale-back of its commitments, citing the remaining signatories' failure to meet their obligations. Political commentator Mr. Frank Emspach believes the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is a challenging task, but it will probably happen.
And I think in terms of Iran, there is a possibility, I think, not a certainty, but a possibility that the United States and Iran will be able to re-sign the accords. I'm not sure, based on what they said today and what they said two or three weeks ago, that the government is at this moment willing to sign without preconditions. And of course, your government has made it clear that preconditions are on the table. So I'm not sure this is going to be such an easy process. I do believe that the Europeans want it to happen. And I think that as part of our efforts to reestablish relations with the Europeans, particularly the Germans and the French, something will be worked out. At least I hope so.
Phase two of large-scale maneuvers by the Iranian Army's ground forces has seen helicopters upgraded with homegrown equipment carrying out nocturnal combat operations. The Army's attack choppers participated in beachhead operations in the southern coasts of the country. Moreover, special forces carried out joint airborne and combat operations during the drills. Electronic warfare operations to jam the enemy's command and control systems were also conducted. Earlier on Tuesday, the Iranian army conducted phase one of its maneuvers.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war game is to evaluate the mobility and offense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile offense units of the Army Ground Forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
Press TV talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi, JOSC.
COVID-19 deaths have now surpassed the grim milestone of 400,000 in the virus-stricken United States. The total death toll is more than the number of Americans who died in World War I, the Vietnam War, and the Korean War combined. The figure comes as 18 U.S. states reported their highest number of daily fatalities in January. According to Johns Hopkins University, that should be the world's worst hit country, has so far reported over 24.2 million confirmed cases of the disease. This is while the country is still struggling to manage its stumbling vaccine distribution program. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says only around 40% of the distributed vaccines have actually been administered. Correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, says the U.S. federal government's failure to provide a comprehensive vaccination plan has resulted in a lagging distribution process.
The vaccine was introduced fairly quickly. The problem is that's where the federal government just stopped being effective, basically. It allowed the states to take up the responsibility for distributing the vaccine. And what happened was, because there was a lack of a comprehensive plan, it left states kind of scrambling as to how to devise a system and roll it out to the citizenry. And that's why we have such a lag now, and that's why even on the president's pace of trying to get this vaccine out into the arms of the people around the United States, it would take years for him to really fully effectively reach the numbers that he first introduced and first purported that he would do. So what will happen inevitably is that the incoming administration, the Biden administration, will have to pick up the slack here and try to roll out the vaccine to the citizenry in a more efficient way. Right now, we're looking at two main vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer, with Johnson & Johnson possibly having an entrant into the market as well, which is expected in upcoming weeks. Of course, the introduction of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will be extremely helpful in trying to get the vaccine to as many people as possible. But for right now, states are constrained. They're dealing with the effects of a virus that's still not under control, but at the same time trying to treat a vaccine, trying to treat a virus with a vaccine without a large comprehensive plan.
The UK has set a record of over 1,600 coronavirus deaths in a single day as Europe keeps struggling with a second wave of the pandemic. The new fatalities has pushed Britain's overall death toll to more than 91,000. The country has also reported a further 33,000 new cases, raising the total to nearly 3.5 million. A steep rise in deaths and cases comes as the country is battling with a new, highly transmissible COVID variant. Portugal's daily death toll also reached a record high for the second consecutive day. Officials registered 218 deaths and over 10,000 new cases in 24 hours. The country has been under lockdown since last week, with hospitals struggling to cope with a surge in infections. And in France, health officials have warned that the coronavirus is still circulating at a, quote, worrying level.
We put our country through two lockdowns, and both times, why did we do it? Because the hospitals were saturated. All of the projections were showing that. We were having infection numbers that could be reaching 50,000 daily cases. Now, is another lockdown a measure that we will take in any case? I can't tell you that for sure. In any case, what I can tell you is that the spread of the virus remains worrying within the country.
Véran also said that France is in a relentless fight to contain the spread of the new variant. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy registered over 10,000 new cases and 603 more deaths. The country has the second highest death toll in Europe. Germany also registered over 11,000 new infections and nearly 1,000 deaths in 24 hours. The government is expected to extend and tighten coronavirus lockdown measures until February the 15th, as fears grow over a new COVID variant. That's your world news for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Joe Biden will sign a series of executive orders in his first days in office, attempting to roll back damage done at home and abroad by Donald Trump, whom the Democrat will replace as president on Wednesday, 20th of January. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Joe Biden Executive Orders Will Reverse Trump on Climate, Iran, COVID, and More. Stay with us for more of Martin Pengelly's article. Joe Biden will sign a series of executive orders in his first days in office, attempting to roll back damage done at home and abroad by Donald Trump, whom the Democrat will replace as president on Wednesday, 20th of January. Biden, 78, has already outlined plans to send an immigration bill and a COVID stimulus and relief package to a newly democratically controlled Congress. On Friday, 15th of January, he said he would shake up the delivery of vaccines against COVID-19, mired in chaos under Donald Trump's administration. Biden plans to return the United States to the Paris Climate Accord and to the Iran nuclear deal, overturn Donald Trump's travel ban against some Muslim-majority countries, restrict evictions and foreclosures under the pandemic, and institute a mask mandate on federal property. In a memo released on Saturday, the incoming White House Chief of Staff Ron Klein said, "These actions will change the course of COVID-19, combat climate change, promote racial equity and support other underserved communities, and rebuild our economy in ways that strengthen the backbone of this country, the working men and women who built our nation." While the policy objectives in these executive actions are bold, I want to be clear. The legal theory behind them is well-founded and represents a restoration of an appropriate constitutional role for the president. The memo did not mention rejoining the World Health Organization, WHO, previously mentioned as a priority. The incoming White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klein, said, "Subsequent orders would address equity and support communities of color, and address criminal justice reform, access to health care, and other priorities." Donald Trump leaves office impeached twice, the second time over an attack on the U.S. Capitol he incited and which left at least five people dead. The coronavirus pandemic is out of control, the death toll approaching 400,000, the caseload close to 24 million. There were nearly 3,300 deaths on Saturday, according to Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. economy has cratered. Unemployment is rising steeply. Among historians assessing the challenge faced by Joe Biden, the Roosevelt and Lincoln biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin told the Washington Post it was huge. "History has shown when you have crises like this," she said, "it is an opportunity for leaders to mobilize resources of the federal government. All the presidents we remember, they dealt with a crisis. When you're given that chance, the question is, are you fitted for that moment?" Joe Biden will enjoy Democratic control of both houses of Congress, if by a slender margin in the House and by Kamala Harris's casting vote as vice president in a 50-50 Senate. But Senate business, including confirmation of Joe Biden's cabinet nominees, will soon be dominated by Donald Trump's impeachment trial. On Sunday, Ron Klein told CNN's State of the Union program, "It's important for the Senate to do its constitutional duty, but also to do its constitutional duty to move forward on these appointments under urgent action the country needs." During the last time President Trump was tried, the Senate was able to hold confirmation hearings for nominees during the morning and was able to conduct other business. "I hope that the Senate leaders, on a bipartisan basis, find a way to move forward on all their responsibilities. This impeachment trial is one of them, but getting people into the government and getting action on the coronavirus is another one of those responsibilities." If Donald Trump is convicted, he could be barred from running for office again. 10 Republican House members voted to impeach over the Capitol riot, making Donald Trump's second impeachment the most bipartisan in history. Senior party figures are anxious to move on, but a clear majority of Republican voters support Donald Trump and back his base's claim that the election was stolen through voter fraud. In Congress, 147 Republicans in the House and Senate objected to Electoral College results. Joe Biden has urged unity and pledged to use his experience in Congress, he was a senator for 36 years, to reach across the aisle. But former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich sought to urge the new president towards radical action and away from seeking significant Republican support. "I keep hearing that Joe Biden will govern from the center," Robert Reich wrote. "He has no choice, they say, because he'll have razor-thin majorities in Congress and the Republican Party has moved to the right." "Rubbish. I've served several Democratic presidents who have needed Republican votes for what they've wanted to do. But the Republicans now in Congress are nothing like those I've dealt with. Most of today's GOP live in a parallel universe. There is no center between the reality-based world and their world." Speaking to the Washington Post, House Majority James Clyburn, a key Joe Biden ally and a leading African-American voice, said he had reminded the president-elect of the power of executive orders, which Harry Truman used to desegregate the military and Abraham Lincoln used to begin the end of slavery. The new White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, is scheduled to give a briefing on Wednesday, Inauguration Day, 20th of January, 4 years after Sean Spicer kicked off the Trump presidency by aggressively lying about the size of the crowd for Donald Trump's inaugural address. Joe Biden will speak and take the oath of office amid massive security, a Washington lockdown prompted by fears of new attacks in the wake of the Capitol riot on Wednesday, 6th of January. James Clyburn urged Joe Biden to lay out your vision and invite people to join you in the effort. But if they don't join you, whatever authority you've got, use it.
Food for thought.
A Hello, dear listeners, and how about listening to thought-provoking words from the Holy Prophet Zik's infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, regarding the lofty epithets in the divine court of his most noble ancestress, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Fatima has nine names near Allah the Exalted. These are Sadiqa, or the most truthful, Mubaraka, or the blessed, Tahira, or the spotlessly pure, Zakiya, or the pristinely chaste, Raziya, Al-Marziya, or the one who is gratified and contented with God's will, Muhaddasa, or the lady to whom angels speak, and Zahra, or the most radiant.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
This type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd al-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program of For Humanity, where we are discussing the reciprocal rights, the treaties of rights of Imam Ali al-Sajjad Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him. And in this Risalatul Huquq, he's speaking about the rights of who you interact with. We need to always be careful and cautious about who it is that we are interacting with and how we conduct ourselves in their presence. Because if I was to be someone who is careless about the common courtesy of what I need to do, then of course this means that I'm going to become a deceitful person, a hypocrite, a bad person, and all of these other negative features that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, has warned us and made sure that he explained that we avoid these kind of qualities in ourselves. If you want to be a person who you interact with as far as others are concerned, you need to make sure you do so in the best of ways, and you are going to be someone who is never oppressing anyone, never telling someone a lie, never cheating on anyone, and always make sure that you honor the rights of those who are around you. That being said, Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَلَا تَعْمَلْ فِي إِنْتِفَاضَةِ عَمَلِ الْعَدُوِ الَّذِي لَا يَبْقَى عَلَى صَاحِبِهِ. Now, this is the third part of the continuation of the segment of Imam As-Sajjad's section on interacting with others. And it means that you don't behave in such a way like as if you're dealing with an enemy. And of course, this segment is really, really surprising, because in reality, it says that even though you might have short interaction with someone, you need to make sure that you don't do certain things, even though it may be as brief and quick. Look at your interests, look at your benefits, but don't be so self-absorbed that you forget the rights of others. And if you have the good qualities, you will be able to have more friends. What's better, for you to have bad qualities and more friends, or to have good qualities and no friends, or to have good qualities and more friends? The answer here is for you to have good qualities and more friends. We can't say, it's wrong for us to say, as Muslims, according to our teachings, that, well, I won't be able to fulfill the correct rights of friends and associates and people who I interact with, and therefore the best thing to do is for me to just completely avoid interacting with people. This is wrong kind of attitude, and it's not something that Islam approves of. We need to mix, we need to mingle, we need to interact, but at the same time, we always need to make sure that we are observing the rights of who we are interacting with. When we see this kind of rights, we are able to understand that the nature of mixing that makes our interaction even better is the intention that we have. Just going to go for a short break, and we will be back very soon.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa alin nabiyyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa alin nabiyyil azim.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And we're talking about intention with who it is that you are interacting with. You know, it might be a very quick encountering, but at the same time, you need to make sure that you leave a good impression, a positive impression, which is the very point that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, is saying. Because, you know, even though you want your own benefits and you want to make sure that these benefits are looked into, you don't want to be an opportunist. You don't want to leave any kind of negative behavior. You don't want to lose your moral standards just for the sake of you getting what it is that you want. Cutting in line is wrong. mistreating someone in the public is wrong. Those people who you are interacting with, for whatever purpose it may be, if you do so with pride, with haughtiness, with takabbur, that's also going to be wrong. If you're going to treat them like an enemy, that's also going to be wrong. And that's why, towards the end, Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَإِنْ اطْمَأَنَّ إِلَيْكَ اسْتَقْصَيْتَ عَلَىٰ نَفْسِكَ وَعَلِمْتَ أَنَّ غُبْنَ الْمُسْتَرْسِلِ riba. And basically, this means that when you come to realize that they trust you, then try with your utmost ability to gain their trust and to keep their trust. And you need to always remember that the breaching of trust is a kind of usury, is a kind of riba. And of course, that's not good in any way. Al-mustarsil here means the person who is dealing with those who are in their company, in their proximity, because they're relying on you. They want to make sure that you are doing this in the best way. Riba means, the reason why the word usury is used, it's kind of like shock treatment to give you the realization of how bad it is if you are going to betray or deceive or do any of these bad things. You don't want to show off. You don't want to do something wrong. You don't want to retaliate. You don't want to wish bad for someone. You want to make sure that you do everything that is of the highest standards for that person. And you need to gain their trust, and you need to make sure that people know that you are an honorable person. You're a positive person. You're someone who can be trusted. And this is exactly what Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, is trying to say here. When you're interacting with people, give off a good image. Make sure that you keep your highest standards. Imam Sajjad is saying you're referring to something which you don't need to overlook. Maybe you might say that, you know, this could be difficult or hard or anything like that, but Islam says have as much relations as possible, and at the same time be careful and cautious that you don't tread over anyone's rights. Keep your standards as high as you can. Please visit us on the website of www.pastoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program here for humanity in the IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Zakia Al-Bakhit has long been begging the Saudi officials to return what's left of her husband. His belongings, including his books and notebooks, his bank documents, and above all, his body. Zakia says, "I want to bury him in a place that suits him, not like someone whose identity is unknown, or like someone who has committed an ugly crime." The story of Zakia is the tragic story of many other Shia women in Saudi Arabia who have lost their husbands to a sinister system of injustice entrenched deeply in the kingdom against religious minorities.
حادث مؤلم جدا.
جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Zakir's husband, Abbas al-Hassan, was beheaded in 2019. He was among the mass execution of 37 prisoners. Riyadh has refused to give at least 33 of the bodies to their families so far. All of these 33 men belong to the Shia community in Saudi Arabia. They were all convicted on terrorism charges after trials that Amnesty International said relied on confessions extracted through torture.
The Saudi government body snatching policy has been a long-standing policy for its political opponent, meaning that they reserve this punishment for those who are against the monarchy. And it's very important legally that nothing in the legal papers or the court ruling that these bodies shall not be returned to their families. The Saudi government continues to practice this criminal way of stealing bodies of political detainees and political opponents. This is in contradiction of all international laws and of Muslim tradition.
Mujtaba al-Suwaikat is just another case executed in April 2019, with his body not returned to his family yet. A teenager who took part in pro-democracy demonstrations back in 2011 and 2012. Mujtaba was tortured by being hung by his hands, beaten on the soles of his feet, and stuffed with cigarettes, according to Al Arabi. His mother says, "We found out that he had been executed from social media. We are insisting on recovering the body because receiving your son's body means to receive your son. This is the least possible right that can be given to a family bereaved by the killing of its son."
You cannot call the Saudi courts a judicial system because they do not operate like a court. It is a kangaroo court that is medieval, it is sectarian, it's apartheid court that does not allow most of the population of Saudi Arabia to be part of it. Meaning, if you are a Shia, you cannot be a judge, you cannot be a prosecutor. If you are black, you cannot be a judge or prosecutor. If you are a woman, you cannot play a role as well. And if you are not from specific regions or specific background, you cannot be. So that excludes the majority of the country's population from taking part in this apartheid court system.
While the kingdom is considering ending the use of the death penalty for drug-related offenses as part of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's disputed reform campaign, Riyadh has no plan to treat political activists and critics humanely. In the words of Ali Adubisi, director of the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, ESOR, the tragedy of Mujtaba al-Suwaikat is repeated so often in Saudi Arabia that it's become the chorus to a gruesome song. Saudi Arabia arrests a child, tortures them, convicts them, kills them, and buries them in a pauper's grave, all for the crime of speaking out against the government. Saudi Arabia has increased its use of the death penalty since King Salman ascended to the throne in 2015. As of April 2020, under King Salman bin Abdul Aziz, at least 800 executions were carried out. 184 executions were carried out in 2019, a rise from 149 in 2018. 37 of these political activists killed en masse following lengthy periods of solitary confinement, torture, and grossly unfair trials, according to Reprieve, a London-based human rights group.
There is not a single case where people who are charged with political crimes have been found innocent. In usually courts, you know, you have people who are guilty, people who are not. But in Saudi Arabia, if you are charged by the Saudi government of any political crime, you are always found guilty. There is not one innocent person, because that's how the court in Saudi Arabia works. Anything that the Saudi government charges you with, the Saudi government gets the punishment that they deserve, that they ask for. And that's how it goes in these courts that are not like other courts around the world, or around even around the region, our region. So these are apartheid courts, and they will never give justice.
Maya Foa, director of Reprieve, says executing prisoners without notice and withholding their bodies shows the extent of the cruelty and calculated violence of the Saudi Arabian death penalty regime. From the start of 2016 through the end of 2019, at least 84 Saudi Shia men were executed or killed in raids by Saudi security forces, according to Essor. None of their 84 families has received a body.
The Saudi government is one of the most, maybe the most anti-Shia government in the world, and that's why there is not a single mayor who is Shia in Saudi Arabia, not now, for the past 60 years, and not a single Shia minister, Shia diplomat, Shia judge, you name it, they don't exist, and that is the sectarian policy of the Saudi government, supported by the English government and by the American government. They know it very well, and they support it just like they supported apartheid in South Africa.
Perhaps the most prominent person executed whose body has not been returned to his family is Sheikh Nimr Bahar al-Nimr, a revered Shia cleric. He was a leading figure in protests that erupted in Eastern Province against Al Saud's discrimination against the Shia community.
The current government and regime held and controlled by Mohammed bin Salman has no interest in changing the Saudi tradition of religious oppression. And the religious oppression or lack of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia is not limited to the Shia. It encompasses everyone, meaning that the Sunni majority, even those who practice Salafi Wahhabi Islam, they are not free to practice what they think. The government enforces its own interpretation. It forces them, their children, to follow its interpretation of Islam. So religious freedom in that country is becoming less, not more.
For a long time, executions have been at the heart of global criticism of Saudi Arabia. But what has been under the radar all along is the kingdom's refusal to turn over the bodies in an act to show utter disrespect to dissidents, to give their families endless pain, and to warn others that it has no tolerance for freedom of expression, especially from minority groups. A world leader in executions, Saudi Arabia has a long way to go, and its young prince's cosmetic exercises would not help the grave situation in the kingdom. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
A new report found that senior U.S. administration officials were fully aware that the zero-tolerance migrant family separation policy would result in children being separated from their families, but pressed ahead with it anyway. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New IG Report Finds Proof of Trump Team Cruelty to Asylum Seekers. Here's the details of this article. As a former leading U.S. Justice Department official recently said, he regretted the role he played in the Trump administration's zero-tolerance migrant family separation policy. In the wake of a scathing Inspector General report, human and civil rights groups pointed to the probe's findings as damning proof of the administration's cruelty toward people seeking refuge in the United States. The Inspector General's report concluded that President Donald Trump, ex-Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and other senior officials were woefully unprepared when U.S. agents started seizing thousands of migrant children from their asylum-seeking parents and relatives who were often imprisoned in concentration camps after entering the United States. First, in a 2017 DOJ pilot program and then nationwide the following year. The report, based on interviews with dozens of DOJ officials and a review of over 200,000 emails and other electronic files, directly implicates Trump in the disastrous policy. It also found that senior administration officials were fully aware that the policy would result in children being separated from their families, but pressed ahead with it anyway. In response to the report, former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein released recently a statement of regret. Since leaving the department, I have often asked myself what we should have done differently, and no issue has dominated my thinking more than the zero-tolerance immigration policy. Rosenstein told NBC News, "It was a failed policy that never should have been proposed or implemented. I wish we all had done better." The ACLU, which successfully sued to block family separation and immediately reunite families, led human and civil rights groups in reacting to what it called the damning report. The barbaric family separation practice was immoral and illegal, said Lee Glurant, the ACLU lawyer who led the family separation suit, in a statement recently. This new report shows just how far the Trump administration was willing to go to destroy these families. Just when you think the Trump administration can't sink any lower, it does. The new DOJ report's findings correspond with those of a 21-month House Judiciary Committee investigation published last October that accused the Trump administration of reckless incompetence and intentional cruelty in its implementation of the zero-tolerance policy. In November, Common Dreams reported that 666 children, about 20% of whom were under the age of 5, when they were ripped away from their parents, remained separated from their families. As a result of the separation,